What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Welcome, I'm Moshe Ferber.
And I am Ariel Munafon.
And this is the Silver Lining Podcast, a podcast about security architecture.
Good morning, everyone. How are you, Moshe?
Perfect. Good morning, Ariel.
We are in another podcast of Silver Lining Media. And today we are with Or. How are you, Or?
I'm great. How are you?
Very good.
Very good. Thank you for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, Or is basically a team leader at Snyk, a very, very, how would they say it, innovative startup. I'm not sure you're a startup anymore. Last round you raised how many? 50 million?
No, like 150.
Wow.
A bit more.
Yeah. I guess, are you considered a unicorn already?
Yeah.
Okay, so congratulations.
Yeah.
Well done. Snyk is a very interesting company. They started off as basically a open source checkup and open source examiner for verifying that your open source is genuine, is authentic. And now you're doing so many other things. So this was the opening. Go ahead and explain a little bit about yourself and what you're doing in Snyk and basically everything you think.
Great. So I'm Or Kamara, 30 years old, married to my amazing wife, Roni.
You can stop now.
And yeah, I've served in the, like, as part of the army in the Prime Minister office for around 8 years, which was an amazing time. And yeah, like everything related to like security, cybersecurity, what you can imagine. And then I joined Snyk around 2 years ago. And basically, I'll give some background around Snyk. So Snyk is an open source security for developers. So yeah, we started around almost 5 years ago, 4 years ago, dealing with open source component of the applications. And then from then we continue with several products. So one of them, which I kind of built from scratch, was the container product. So the same thing for application that you can imagine, like looking for the open source dependencies, the same thing for the containers, looking for the OS packages that are being part of the container, and which is right now the second product of Snyk. And at the moment, like a few months ago, I started working on a new product, which is totally different. And the new product is around cloud configuration. And basically the concept is, again, helping the developers understanding the differences, understanding the issues that can be part of the configuration of their cloud tools. So things like Kubernetes, things like Terraform, CloudFormation, all of those. So it's like a different area that still wraps the application, right? It's like part of the application, but it's a big unknown at the moment for a developer because it's like a huge thing. It's a like it's not easy to be an expert in Kubernetes, specifically not in security. So this is what we're trying to do.
Okay.
So do you spend the last couple of months doing research on the class misconfiguration and building your own product, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
Is it the product is available already?
Yeah. So like right now it's still a private beta, but like in the next month, right before KubeCon, we will release a public beta, so it will be free for everybody.
We will be in the air when when the feature will be on, when the product will be on.
Okay, so good luck with your product.
Thanks.
And basically, because of your research on cloud misconfiguration, and we decided to have you here and talk a little bit more about cloud misconfiguration and the reason for that and what we can do about it. And we, in the preparation conversation, we decided to focus on the Capital One hack. A couple of months ago, Capital One, a large bank, was hacked. The hacking made a big noise, first of all, because it's a bank, and it's always and it's always get bigger headlines. Mm-hmm. Second, there's a large number, 150 million, if I'm not mistaken, record, something like that. One of the biggest hacks. And the third, it was a very complicated hack. Some rumors about AWS malicious internal threat, which apparently wasn't true. I have to say, disclaimer, we don't know anything about Capital One hack except what was in the public media. Capital One hack didn't share with us anything, right? Anything we're going to say is based on what we read in the media. But I have to say that the attack vector are pretty, we are familiar with most of them already. So there's no big surprises there. It's just a complication and basically the aggregated of all the different misconfiguration vulnerabilities into one result, which makes this story so fascinating.
It's a combination of few failures, right? Mm-hmm. In the application, in the cloud environment, all of those together led to this problem.
Okay, so let's give a short review. What were the main steps in the Capital Hack 1? Just to Capital Hack 1. Capital One hack.
So again, as we're familiar with, the first step was a service that was exposed to the internet, but it should have been like an internal one, but still people had an access to the service from the internet.
So it wasn't a declared web server. It was a web server, but it shouldn't have been open to the internet.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the web application was behind a proxy, like a modsec web application proxy, a firewall, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. So the service was behind a firewall, like a web application firewall, mopsec, and basically we still not sure why, but somehow the attacker had an access to an SSRF vulnerability, and using this SSRF vulnerability, the attacker used like the internal URL of the cloud metadata service of AWS, and then using this API, this metadata API, basically got the credentials of S3 buckets that were attached to the EC2 instance, and then using those credentials, the attacker actually used like access the bucket and sync all of the data from I think around the 700 buckets, which is a lot.
Mm-hmm. So he managed to scrape each one of them, and probably in one of them or some of them, he found the user data. That's the story.
Yeah.
Okay, and this story is fascinating basically because it's utilizing all the attack vector we've been warning about for years, like open too much permissions to the S3 buckets, mm-hmm. and using access keys, and the way that you use basically the access keys or the API keys, and exposing servers that shouldn't be exposed to the internet. So all the failures are here in one place.
Yeah.
So let's start reviewing them step by step and see what kind of configuration or misconfiguration were made and what kind of configuration can we do in order to prevent next one.
Mm-hmm. So should we start with the metadata service?
I think before that, first of all, let's focus on the internet-facing servers. I mean, from my point of view, recently we at the CSA launched an advanced exercise of DevSecOps, and one of the tools that we build over there is it's basically Lambda function, serverless function, and it's what it does. It runs every couple of minutes, and it's checking which servers are exposed to the internet mm-hmm. against a list of yeah, servers.
Just a simple check, right?
Just a simple check. They have a white list of servers that should be exposed to the internet, and they have a black list. And they're checking if there's a server that is not in the list, and it's exposed to the internet, it's blocked. And we do this as an exercise. I mean, it's so easy to do it mm-hmm. when you're talking cloud, when you have an orchestrated environment.
Yeah.
So I think the first thing that we need to focus on is this.
Yeah. So I think that the major problem there was again kind of a misconfiguration in the firewall. So they had a firewall, which is like the first step of the security, but then something went wrong. So maybe it was like the mode of the firewall. Maybe it was only on a like tracing or logging mode and not like actually blocking mode. And maybe it was disabled for I don't know, for a few hours, or maybe there was a different work like a different thing the hacker actually used, which is still unknown. But yes, at the end, like it was exposed to the internet for some reason. I guess that like using techniques as you just mentioned could have blocked those kind of exposures.
Yeah, and again, we haven't discussed this with anyone from Capital One, but usually best practice is do not expose the servers directly to the internet. Mm-hmm. Expose them through some kind of a proxy or a load balancer that can prevent some of the attacks. Again, maybe on this occasion the load balancer was not suitable because they used, I don't know, specific kind of configuration. Yeah. But bottom line is you should be very careful not exposing the servers directly. Just use a load balancer. It's easy. It's cheap. It prevents so many attacks at the web layer. So do it. Mm-hmm. Simply do it.
Why not?
Yeah. Well, basically, yeah. Again, unless you have a really strange configuration or something that cannot work at even the network load balancer or the application load balancer, expose it through a load balancer. Gives another hope, and it stops all kind of different attacks. So basically, the first problem was the servers exposed to the internet, and the second problem was that it had SSRF vulnerability enabled on the web servers. Can you give us two words on SSRF and what is the meaning in this environment?
Yeah, so SSRF is like server-side request forgery.
You did it good.
Yeah, yeah, thanks. I spent like 1 hour like learning this. But the concept is that there is like a service that exposes a regular API, okay? And part of the parameters that the API accepts is like just a URL. So you can imagine like accessing an internal database, and one of the parameters for this request is the URL itself. So you can the attacker can use this API and change the default URL or accessing a different URL inside the internal network. Mm-hmm. And this is what the attacker did here. They actually took a different URL, which is the URL of the metadata service, and then they just had an access to the metadata service from the internet.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can you give a couple of words on the metadata service?
Yeah, so the metadata service is part of the services that the platform exposed for the developers in order to get information about like all of the environment from the like for example the instances. So one use case can be let's say that there is a piece of code that depends on the type of machine, the type of instance that the application is running on. So this piece of code need to query AWS and ask him, okay, which type of machine I'm running on, and if it's like a strong one, I can do something like the first option, and if it's like a small one without any memory, without any CPU, it can do like a different one. So this metadata service basically exposes lots of data about like the environment and for the use of for the internal use of the everything running on the platform.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so basically the metadata service is it's an internal service, and servers should access it internally. So
it should be an internal service.
It should be an internal service. And the SSRF basically enabled the attacker to access this service from the outside.
Exactly.
It's like the web server is becoming some kind of a proxy and routes all the traffic from the all the requests from the attacker to the metadata service. Going step backward, metadata service exists at all cloud provider, Google, Amazon, Microsoft. It's not Amazon specific. It's not Amazon fault. It usually works the same. The idea is that you have some kind of URL that you are accessing from the server side. It's if somebody encountered the URL that is one that has the address 169.254.254.169.254. This is basically the
impressive
the auto configuration service. It's basically part of an old service. It's part of the DHCP backbone in the old days. It's called a network auto configuration service, and cloud provider basically used a new version of it to give the instance all the details that it needs, like the instance name, the instance IP address. Everything is loaded to the metadata service, and the server know how to read it from the metadata service and load it and load all the configuration. And the biggest thing that you can get from security point of view, the biggest thing that you can get from the metadata service is basically the access keys. Now, we keep saying to people, don't do mistake with access keys, don't keep them on disk. Well, the metadata service is a way to get the access keys without putting them on disk. But as we can see, it doesn't solve all the problems, right? Not getting them on disk. Because it's a URL and you can access it through the SSRF vulnerability, then the information is visible to the attacker. And the one thing that I want to really emphasize here is the fact that Amazon, because of Capital One, we think this is because of Capital One, they changed the metadata service and upgraded to version 2. Have you been exploring a bit about the difference between version 1 and version 2?
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about it?
So maybe the first thing to say is that it's not, you need to opt in to this new version. And I'm going to explain what exactly it is, but it basically means that it's not on by default. So if someone is interested in enabling this feature, they need to turn it on. And basically, I think that AWS just trying to solve the specific issue that happened in Capital One. And basically, as I mentioned before, like using the SSRF, it was possible to do a GET request and then access the metadata service. So what AWS did, they changed the format of the kind of the handshake, and before the first request for the credentials of the AIM role, they just added another step of like creating a session for a certain amount of seconds, a few seconds, and then like using this session token, you can like do the next steps. But basically what they change is that instead of like another GET request, it's now like a put, HTTP put. And basically most of the SSRF vulnerabilities are using the GET request that as I said before, but now they are blocked. Mm-hmm.
So basically, because it's harder to do a put request in SSRF, AWS simply hardened the access. You first need to do a put request, then you'll have access to your API keys.
Yeah. But again, it's just an hardening. It's not like it's not a bulletproof at the moment. I think they, you know, there are lots of discussion in the internet if it's like the correct solution or not. And lots of smart developers trying to say it's not as good as AWS trying to say, but I think it's like another step forward. It's much better than it was before, but again, like lots of places for improvement.
And what is if I can ask the misconfiguration? What they did wrong? Is it only an AWS problem?
Basically, the did wrong was along the SSRF.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the problem is that because of the way metadata worked. Every time you had an SSRF, it's game over.
Okay.
Because you can get the access keys. So now it's
a little more difficult.
It's a little bit more difficult. That's the idea. But I can relate to this a little bit more. And if anything we do, we're just putting the walls higher, a little bit higher. There's never a one wall that finishes this all. Yeah. Everything we do is put another layer in the wall.
Yeah, and like, and I can say that in this case, the attacker accesses the metadata service, but like they can also use the same SSRF vulnerability to access the MongoDB API, right? And mm-hmm. to do something else, to change something on or delete something. And again, it's like, as you just said, it's like you need to change all the time, and you need to change the high of the walls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So basically, up until now, this our recommendation is don't make SSRF vulnerabilities. I mean, cover your SSRF vulnerabilities. Make sure that your WAF is blocking SSRF if possible. And also, you need to opt in for the version 2 of the metadata service if you want, again, to not to eliminate the SSRF problem, but to make it much, much harder. Yeah. Because of in version 2, you need to put you need to use POST and not only GET request, which is harder. Okay, so the attacker got the access keys from the metadata service. What's now?
So now they just saw that they had an access to the like which one of the S3 buckets. So they had two permissions. The first one for listing all of the buckets, and then I guess that they saw like an impressive list of 700 buckets, which is always nice. And then they actually had the permission to sync, which is basically to download all of the content of those buckets into their own environment.
I just can imagine like a kid finding
exactly
all the toys, you know? It's amazing.
Yeah. Only in our case, it wasn't a kid. Somebody hacked them in order to hack them.
Yeah.
I mean, kids are usually browsing the bucket, and then they're looking for open buckets, and then they found it. But somebody made a big progress to get to this point.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not a kid. Yeah. It's not a script kiddie. So again, we are back to S3. Permissions, which is something we talked a lot about. Give us a couple of insights about S3 and the buckets and how do we do permission properly.
So the first thing to say is that it's very complex. Okay, there are multiple ways to solve it, and maybe this is one of the problems, right? I think there are like, I don't know, at least three different ways. Each one of them is separate from the other to protect the S3 buckets. Mm-hmm. And like maybe the fact that you have so many options is what like makes so many, like what actually leads to so many
mistakes.
Yeah. And yeah, so like the first one, which I guess that like most of the audience are pretty much familiar with, is like just to assign an S3 bucket policy, which basically means to define who can access this kind of a bucket. And again, it's from the bucket perspective. It's not from the user user or the service perspective. It's from the bucket perspective. And the second option is to use IAM roles and to assign a specific policy to each one of the IAM roles. And this option is more from the service and the user perspective and not from the bucket perspective.
Mm-hmm. So basically, trying to elaborate more on what you said, you can use policies, which is basically bucket policy or resource policy, as mm-hmm. AWS call them, which is giving permissions from the bucket side. Who can access me?
Yeah.
And over there, you say you give only the application that needs to access the relevant permissions.
Exactly.
And probably it shouldn't include sync. Usually a read-only. And second, you need to think if you need to give it to 700 buckets.
Yeah. And it depends on the case, right? Sometimes you need to have like a sync permission. But like not always, and not for each one of the IRM role. Like this case.
Yeah. Again, not judging Capital One, but usually the sync role is made in order to provide sync between different buckets. Mm-hmm. And you shouldn't give this to an instance. Instance doesn't really need this this permission. But judging from the use case, even if they give only read permission, that's also a problem on this case. So the question would be how many buckets the application should access, not if should access all of them. But we stopped in the middle. We said that one way to do it is from the service, from the bucket point of view, the bucket permissions. Another way to do this is IAM role, which basically give the servers a role that allows them to access S3. And you can do either one of those, or you could do both of them. And actually, AWS gives you so many ways to do S3 security. I mean, you have a blocking control, like preventative controls, like the permissions, and you have detective controls, like Amazon Meshare that scans the buckets, looking for PIIs and stuff, and open buckets and stuff like this. You have you can do detective controls with AWS Config, and you can look at CloudTrail to see if permission has changed. You have a compensating control, like you can run a Lambda each time the permission has changed and change it over again. So basically, yeah, you have so many tools, so sometimes the organization don't even know what to activate. Yeah. Sometimes things look too complicated.
And also encryption, right? It's also a useful one.
Yeah.
I think I read somewhere that it was on for the Capital One, but maybe there was a permission to change the setting as well. So,
yeah, well, it could be on, but if it's a server-side encryption, SSC, if I think the name of it is, and then the key is kept in the storage, so everybody can take out the encrypted data. If you're using a specific key, then you need to give the permission to the instance to the key, and if they and this is also a way to block it. Also, a couple of years ago, we did a demo at DEF CON, and we showed how we do a bucket access policy. Basically, you can access the file or the bucket only if you have a specific referrer in the header. This would also prevent this, because the attacker wouldn't know which kind of header to put in the HTTP request. It would also block this attack. But again, it's so many options. The problem is the right methodology.
We talked in one of our former previous episodes with the former CISO of Oracle Cloud. And something that he said is that the cloud providers need to take more responsibility, but also make the things simpler. It's really it's really hard to follow everything. And
yeah, and think about companies that use like cross platforms environment. So like handling this problem also in Google and also in Azure, it's like insane, right?
This is why you can raise 150 million.
That for sure. Okay, so S3 permissions are very hard to understand. It's not easier in Google or in Microsoft. I don't know if the entire model is broken. Okay, I'm not sure about it, but it's definitely getting too complex, and people find it hard to keep up with the right permission, with the right permission set. I have to say, by the way, in the favor of Capital One, up until now we talk about all the mistakes, but other attacks that follow the same path got an access key that allowed them to delete the entire environment. So the good thing for Capital One is that they found only access key that allowed them to sync the S3 bucket. It could be a very different story.
Yeah.
So basically they did a few things definitely well. They isolated this application. It can only access specific buckets. The API key was probably not able to do much more. Otherwise, we would see the attacker do much more.
Yeah. And at the end, I think the attacker actually had an access only to part of the data. So this is actually really good, right? Because imagine that they could have actually gained an access to all of the data of Capital One, then it probably was a much more disaster.
Yeah. Mm. We've seen scenarios when people find the keys and started deleting servers and data.
Yeah.
So they were lucky on this scenario.
So we have something else, or we move to our next step?
Do we have anything else about the technology? I mean, we pretty much talked about, I think, the technology aspect of it. Of course, detection. I mean, you need to have CloudTrail enabled and S3 logs in order to verify.
Yeah, which they actually did, right? Like, this is how they managed to understand what actually happened, which is very important. I think we're pretty much okay.
Okay, I have to say one thing about it again. Usually we know that organization will take between 6 months to a year to understand when they get hacked. we see every time we see that in cloud environment, it takes much, much, much less. If you have CloudTrail and S3 logs enabled, and then you get pretty good visibility over what happened. One thing to say, Capital One figure out really fast what was going on there, even though it was a sophisticated attack. And this we can say was a good cloud configuration effort, probably.
Yeah.
Okay. So this was technology, and we always try to put things about technology, people, and process. Can you tell us a little bit what you think about the people angle here? I mean, what can be done? This is more in general because we don't really know what the situation in Capital One. Let's talk in general. What should the developers and IT and operations should know?
So I think basically at the moment there is a huge gap between like in the ownership and the responsibility of those area. So let's say that I'm part of a team that owner a specific application. So which part of this application should I own? Is it like only the few lines of code that I wrote? Is it like the dependency? Is it like the container? Is it like the Kubernetes? There are so many things. And now we have the S3 on AWS and we have Terraform script. So who exactly is the owner of those area? So we can say that the owner is like the developer, but if we say so, then we need to have the right tools, then we need to have the right approach and the right education for those developers, and it's not trivial at all, right? Mm-hmm. We don't want to make all of the developers like DevOps people, right? It's a different role. But this is the gap. This is the main gap I see here. There are lots of things that are around the application, and it's not simple as it used to be.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Again, back to what we said: give the provider tool, give the developer tools. And we had one of our early episodes was Guy Fletcher, the CISO for AppsFlyer, and I said, mm-hmm. I give them guardrails. I mean, I let them follow a path. They can go their own way, but I make sure that they don't divert.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tools like the one I mentioned, like scanning your environment and verify that none of the servers got exposed to the internet, is like giving them guardrails. Do whatever you want. I will make sure you're not passing my permission boundaries. Okay, from the process point of view, I mean, how can you make sure that, I know Snyk is very big on CI/CD processes, mm-hmm. and how to change how to shift from traditional security into the new security.
Yeah, so like maybe the major first, major step in the process is maybe around, less about the CI, but more about the review and the education, as I mentioned before. So if no one from the team is familiar with Kubernetes, then maybe someone from the security, the platform, the DevOps team need to help them. Same thing about like the cloud, the platform itself. So reviewing the IAM roles, reviewing the network policies, reviewing like whatever it is, there are lots of things to review, but reviewing those things from the security perspective, it's really, really important. And maybe it should be a part of like merging the code into production. Mm-hmm. From other things we can, like other tools we can use are more about the pipelines itself, themselves. For example, I'm not sure if you're familiar with OPA, the Open Policy Agent. So it's kind of a generic policy agent, as it implies, created by the CNCF. And the goal is to have policies around like generic policies engine, and you can define exactly each one of those policies. And I can give some examples. So let's say that as part of your Kubernetes configuration, you want to make sure that each one of the services, each one of the Kubernetes objects, there is a label for the name of the team. So if there is an error or production, you can talk directly with the team or just ping them automatically. So this is like one example for policies that you create. Mm-hmm. And other policies you can do is for security. So imagine that the DevOps or the platform team just define all of those security, all of those policies, and then just help the developers and not doing any mistakes mm-hmm. as part of the regular pipeline. OPA can basically being used for each scenario. So Kubernetes is one of them. Terraform is also another scenario. It's a great tool.
Okay. So anything else then in the process side that you think that can help?
So I think that, like, first of all, you need to give the developers visibility about what's actually going on, right? So Snyk is a good example for displaying all of the dependencies, right? But also other tools can help the developers actually understand what's going on the platform, or understand what are the differences between the platform, what's actually running on the platform, and what actually defined inside the code. Mm-hmm. So there is the concept of infrastructure as code, right? Mm-hmm. But imagine that everything is amazing in my organization. Everything is everything is inside GitHub, and then there is a new developer that manually created a new bucket. Okay, so this is a problem, right? Because if I expect everything to be automatically, and then someone just doing things manually, then it's a problem. So one tool, for example, is which is for Terraform, is a tfdiff, which basically kind of compare the environment between what the definition and between what's actually going on.
A visual source.
kind of. I think, again, there are lots of tools. Mm-hmm. Each one of them can be specifically for each one of a specific tool, specific area. And I think that it's more about how the company helps the developers, and how they help them understand the problem. It's not enough to say, okay, there might be a potential risk with a IAM role if the developers don't understand what IAM role is, right?
Yeah. It is interesting because you said it's a process. It's not just one thing, and it's not even about tools. It's mindset, gap knowledge, and taking care of the things.
Exactly.
Okay, so try to summarize all of this. Misconfiguration in the cloud is a big thing, and you get so many hacks due to that. Capital One is one example where we see a combination of vulnerabilities and misconfiguration leading to an hack, basically. And this is what we see in the last big hacks. It's a combination of different misconfiguration and different of in some places where you don't use the least privileges and you open a little bit, and this is basically the way. So for Capital One specifically, we talk about SSRF and the metadata access service, but it's always the same. Follow the least privileges principle, less privileges. This is what I was going after. Have less privileges for every action you need to make, and follow, basically monitor your environment all the time. Make sure that servers that should be exposed to the internet are not exposed. Make sure that your WAF is configured correctly. Understand all the little tweaks that cloud provider will give you, like the version 2 that can stop SSRF to the metadata. I mean, there are all sorts of those little things that you can do. S3 permission policy, you have to define your methodology around it and build your also detective controls and also your preventative mm-hmm. and compensating controls around it. I think this is one of the biggest challenges here. Make sure that when you use API keys, again, you don't keep them in on disk or something like that. I would say I always recommend use the metadata service. Mm-hmm. but we can see this is not a bulletproof solution as well. So probably my next recommendation would be use a parameter store or secret store or some kind of external vault mechanism. I guess we are going that way the metadata service is not secured anymore, even in this version 2. And when we talk about process and people, give the provider give the developers knowledge, right? This is what you're saying. Let them understand what they're doing. Let them be owners of things. Just give them good enough tools to verify that you can be that you can audit them, and you can definitely tell them, okay, over here you open the bucket, over here you have a server exposed to the internet, so you can basically guardrail them into the right direction.
Yeah,
that's pretty much summarizing things.
Yeah, it was a long one.
Yeah, but,
yeah, I think like the main key point for me is that basically there are. Someday there will be a problem in your network. Someday there will be a misconfiguration because there are so many things to do. And the first thing to do is to act fast, right? Mm-hmm. So in order to act first, you need to have a clear owner for that.
Yeah.
Somebody is at the door, but continue. Yeah. It's, okay. It's our next guest.
Yeah.
So we need to have a clear owner for that. And this is why each and every team should talk about those things, mm-hmm. and not just keep a vague gap, like mm-hmm. for the ownership.
Okay. Yeah. We, at the CSA, we call it limiting their blast radius. I mean, at certain point, you will have some kind of misconfiguration. The biggest question would be, will it affect all of your environment or simply pieces of it? So you want to limit the attack, the blast radius, to make sure that it will only affect as little as possible.
Exactly.
Okay, well, it was really interesting. Thank you for being with us and sharing your knowledge. And we will check your next product.
Maybe. Yeah, good luck with the launch of your product. Yeah.
And thanks again. It was my first podcast.
Ah, okay.
Good luck.
Thank you very much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed.
Yeah.
So thanks to all our listeners. And you can share, comment. And if you want to talk also, contact us. Bye-bye.
Save big money on everything for your next project at Menards. Spring is here, making it the perfect time for outdoor projects. Suncast storage sheds are an excellent solution for protecting outdoor lawn and gardening tools. They're easy to assemble, and the all-weather construction provides water resistance and UV protection. Save big on Suncast storage sheds. View our selection of Suncast products today in-store and on Menards.com. Save big.